I don't know.
You know something, Mark? Let's just go, because I don't know if it's going to go. We're recording on Zoom, so we may have to just record it and put it live on, we'll put it on YouTube. Again, there's a problem with this.
You know? But you guys were going to put it on YouTube anyway, right?
Yes, yeah, we always do put it on YouTube.
Yeah.
It just, it keeps just saying, preparing for Facebook Live. And
well, it might just take a few seconds, I guess, to get it ready.
Usually it goes right, you know, it loads right up. But we could, Mark, we could record, and then when it, hopefully it'll load, and you know, we'll be ready to go. And I could put it, I'm going to also put it on YouTube, so.
All right, you ready then?
Yeah, you ready to go? Let's go.
Let's do it.
All right, what's up? Welcome to another episode of Police Off the Cuff After Hours. My name is Mark DeMeo. I'm your host, my co-host, my partner in all things law enforcement, the very handsome Bill Cannon.
What's going on? I wish I had more credentials as an engineer, because we're having problems with this engineering part of this bullshit, you know? Like Tom Delgado, I know he does his own editing. He does everything. He's a one-man band.
Well, that's okay. So let's introduce our he's a hilarious comedian. He's also a tour guide here in New York City. He's got a law degree, and he's just returned from Mount Everest, folks. Climbing Mount Everest for the third time. Put your hands together for Tom Delgado.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Correction.
Like one of those guys
just got done. It was actually my third time this year climbing it. I just wanted to correct you. Sorry about that.
Sometimes you just get to the bottom and you just, you know what? I'm just going to climb it again, right?
Yeah, it was easier than I thought. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do it twice while I'm here.
Did you acclimatize?
I did. I acclimatized immediately. Once I got there, as soon as I got off the plane, I was like, I feel good. And I just walked.
Well, you could be an oceanographer.
Yeah. That's going to be my next trip, I think. I'm going to head to the, you know.
Jacques Cousteau's grandson has his own show now.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
No, that's you.
All right. Oh, sure, sure. I'll claim that Jacques Cousteau is my grandfather.
Look
at this.
I'm thinking of all the things that you look like that could be a track star.
I feel like I look like a colonist, like an early American colonist with this hair just coming out from the sides like this.
Okay. Yeah. You do marathons.
He should get his own TV show, man. He could go anywhere in the world and do a tour. You ever watch his tours on YouTube?
No, I want to see. I want to talk to you about that.
Oh, man, he's pretty damn knowledgeable. He knows everything about the city.
Yeah, that's kind of what I do,
about,
I guess.
Tell us about this job of yours. I'm fascinated by it.
All right, so I guess a few years ago, so I left law. You were talking about the law degree. I left law like 7 years ago, and I had a bunch of savings, and I blew through all my savings, of course. And then it was a question of what I had to do for money. Well, I had to do something for money. So I had some friends who were comedians, actually, who were tour guides, and they're like, you should do this tour guiding thing. So I just started doing the tour guiding. I took the test, which was a joke. I think it's just basically to test if you're a conscious human being. And then I became a tour guide, and you know, I've been doing that for a few years, and I don't know, I just kind of love history. So I'm always reading a book about New York and just kind of doing that. And I don't do it as much guiding as much anymore, but I make these videos now on YouTube, my YouTube page, Tom DNYC. And I just make these like different things. I visit businesses. I do walks around the city and just kind of talk about New York. It's pretty cool.
You got a pretty damn big audience too.
It's growing. It's growing. Actually, we were talking about this before you started recording, but one of the few nice things about this like whole quarantine is that you have all this time to kind of dedicate to something you've been putting off. And for me, that was just the videos and editing and just making them more often and being more, you know, I don't know, more committed to it. So that's helped, and it's grown. Yeah, it's grown a little bit.
That's pretty amazing. You know, I saw the other day you did a tour of Greenwich Village. And you had 57,000 views.
I think it was the Midtown one's gotten the most. It's look, we're streaming live on YouTube. Speaking of, look at that.
I'm trying to put it up right now because obviously it's not going to stream on Facebook, so I'm putting it on YouTube live.
But yeah, no, I did this the video Midtown. I got a few.
We're streaming live on YouTube. Speaking of, look at that. I'm trying to put it up right now.
I can hear you through the screen, Bill.
Facebook, so I'm putting it on YouTube live.
Are we going to listen to the last 15 minutes?
No, we're good. We're good now. It's still what technical bullshit. Anyway, you know, there's a million other things you could do too. I mean, you ever think you and I could do a homicide tour of New York City?
Yes, we could. I don't know if you knew this, Mark, but me and Bill actually did a video together. We did a video about crime in New York. Obviously, Bill came from the angle of having worked as a homicide detective for 27 years. I remember.
That's right.
And then I came from it at like a historical angle and pointed out different things around the city. So we walked around together. It was pretty great.
It was good because we were at Umberto's Clam Bar. That's no longer, right?
Yeah, Umberto's Clam House moved.
Yeah.
And then we went up to his precinct. What's your precinct?
23.
I showed him 23.
I showed him Rayo's, where they had that murder inside Rayo's that time, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We drove around. It was great. Bill, you got to flash his badge. It was pretty impressive to watch him flash his badge at people.
He was trying to flash his tour guide badge. It didn't do much.
Yeah, but it was good. It was a good one. You have to watch that, Mark. We'll have to do one together.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by this. The tour guide. Is it a walking? First of all, are you doing it now, the walking ones? Is anybody?
Not really. I've had a couple people reach out for like private stuff, and I'll meet up with them, and those usually pay better, and they're more fun to do, and but they come less frequently, and I'll do those now if people reach out to me and stuff, but no, not regularly. It's good though. You know, you socially distance, you wear your mask, you do all that stuff, and then you just do the tour, and it's fine. Like, but it's just not as often as you need it to be.
Most of
the money in tour guiding tips, or you get a set fee?
Well, it's a set fee, and then people tip what they want. But one of the ways I've been making money is I've been doing virtual tours during the pandemic. So this one woman I know who has a pretty big following on YouTube, she does these live virtual tours of the city. And she gets like, you know, 700 people in there watching live, and people will tip. And that's how I've been making a lot of my money during quarantine, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's definitely a useful useful trait to have, man.
Yeah, and it's cool because people from all over the world who love to be in New York, who love to see what's happening here, can just watch and just be like, oh, look at that. There's the Empire State Building. There's the whatever. Look how empty it is.
Especially now, you have a lot of people that
are curious.
But also, too, they might be away.
Right, they're away as well.
You know, and they're like, well, let's see what the city's like. You know what? Let's just check this out. And so this is the tour that you used to do, or that you do, you can't really you do. That's the walking tour, or is it on a bus?
No, I did walking stuff. I did walking stuff, and I do it in like addition to like, you know, commercials and acting stuff and auditioning and stand up. It was just one of the things that I did. Some years it would pay for more of my life than others. And right now, actually, I'm doing the tour guiding stuff, and it's a walking private stuff and the virtual stuff I'm telling you as well. But I'm also writing for a podcast that's coming out, I guess, in the winter, and just trying to juggle everything, man. Just trying to stay afloat.
But I'm fascinated by the. Are you meeting people on a certain, like, because you can't really, can you cover the whole city in one shot?
No, absolutely not. I mean, you could spend like
of the city.
Well, it depends. I mean, it depends. If you're doing a private one, people will ask you like, oh, I really love architecture. So you just map out like, okay, well, these are some cool buildings that cover the spectrum of different architectural styles, and you move from one place to the place. It also depends on how much time you have. You know, if they're like, I have 8 hours in the city, I want to do show me what you can. And you just put together like, all right, I'll show you all the highlights. If they want to see a specific neighborhood, sometimes people will be like, show me, you know, Queens, or show me something in Queens, or show me something here. You're like, all right, well, you just pick something and you do it that way. That's when you do it private. If you do it for a company, they tell you what to do.
Okay. I did it once. It was by accident. I was driving a car service, and I had the guy Star, like more, I think it was Maurice Star or Kenson. One of these star. He was a New Kids on the Block manager.
Oh, wow.
One of the groups had a brother, a younger brother.
Knight?
I had him and the manager in the car with me, and he wanted to entertain the kid. So he was like, take us to some places. And I, you know, I'm from New York, but to me, I'm looking at this kid in the back. He's like 12 years old. I'm like, who wants to see buildings and shit like that? So I took him through where the Hoovers used to be on 11th Avenue and 26th Street. Mm-hmm. And we went up and down because back then, 26th, 27th Street, 28th Street, you could see prostitutes during the day, streetwalkers. and just go down and, you know, talk to him. I pull over and say, hey, say hi to the kid, you know, tell me your name. And then we go to another one, and he was bugging the kid. And then we went down the village. And back then, you know, like, it was an unusual place because you could see, like, openly, you know, gay people affectionate, which wasn't, that was, like, located in that area. So we went there. We went to some of these cool stores in the village. He got a watch with the two faces on it. And then the guy gave me a $100 tip, man.
That's great. That's what I remember. That's exactly what you do. Like, so one time I did a tour for one of the richest men in Europe. He's worth like $5 billion or something. We rode around in a limo for a few hours. The guy gave me $200. I was like, well, it's technically not that much to you, but I'll take it. You know, yeah. I was like, you could do better than $200, buddy. You're worth $5 billion.
So what do you think it was, lira? 200 lira?
Yeah, right. Exactly, dude. We take dollars here, buddy. Come on, cough it up.
Now, do you study up on the city to know all these little that little Fitbits?
Yeah, man. I'm always reading. I'm always reading more stuff and always like researching more stuff. I'm always reading something about New York, I guess, just to kind of, you know, learn more about it. And history generally has always been interesting to me. I always like to read and write. And so that's why I went to freaking law school. I shouldn't have done that. But but yeah, I was almost a history major. And I always hated math. So here I am, you know.
You know, I'm fascinated by the area downtown, that Five Corners, where they made
Five Points. Yeah.
5 Points, yeah.
Where they made the gangs in New York.
Yeah, that's Chinatown now.
Yeah. You know what? I guess you have to – that's an interesting area. People should probably want to know about that when they come, right? Don't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, you're in law enforcement. You should definitely know about the 5 Points. I mean, the 5 Points was like one of the most notorious slums in the history of the United States. I mean, the movie Gangs of New York was based on the 5 Points. And it's interesting because as a cop, you should know that back then, one of the things that cops did for extra money was take people slumming. So like rich people who wanted to see this crazy place but were too scared to go by themselves would pay cops to basically be tour guides for them.
Yeah, and they showed that in the movie.
You know, yeah, exactly. John C. Reilly was that guy. He was the police officer.
They did that after 9/11. A lot of celebrities came down to Ground Zero.
Oh, really?
And yeah, captains and above would give them tours of the devastation that was Ground Zero.
Were they getting paid for that, though?
No, it was just like a favor they did for like celebrities, you know, that wanted to see what it looked like down there.
And right.
A lot of them got really, really upset, you know, on the tour. You know,
I'm sure that's got to be pretty horrifying to see.
Just seeing it. Yeah. So that sort of reminds me, you know, history always repeats itself, maybe in a different form, you know.
Yeah, right, right. I guess the difference was back in that day, like the police was like super corrupt in like the 1800s. So they were literally like, here, give me $100 and I'll walk you around, you know?
Well, it was the whole thing with Tammany Hall, you know, yes. The history of New York City. And the politicians were so corrupt. They actually had to sell positions on the New York City Police Department.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Promotions too.
Yeah, they would give positions to people for supporting them and for basically being their cronies, you know?
That's how you got on.
That's how Bill got on.
Yeah, that's how I got on, yeah. I went from bartender to, you know, police sergeant.
From bartender in 1870 to police sergeant.
They'd come here and they'd have some money and they'd give it and they'd get a job. The Irish guys would get a job as a cop.
That's right. That's right.
Well, you know, historically, I worked at one of the most famous bars in the city. I was a bartender at Pete's Tavern on 1870.
That's right. You remember you telling me that.
And it was, they say the oldest original bar. It was opened in 1864. And they had a lot of that Tammany Hall, because Tammany Hall was right up the street on Irving Place.
Right, right.
And the politicians from Tammany Hall used to come into Pete's Tavern, you know. And it was a speakeasy during Prohibition.
Yep. It was a flower shop.
Yeah, it was a flower shop, exactly. Yeah. And they said even they had these big doors, horses would actually come into the bar, you know. Imagine that. I'll have a gin and tonic.
That was a pretty good horse there, Bill. Nice work.
And whatever this guy wants.
Yeah,
exactly.
Just give the horse what he wants.
Yeah, that was that. You're right.
The show Copper is about all that.
There's a show
on Netflix.
Yeah. Well, there's a cool, interesting history with police too in New York. Like they started out, there was two police forces in New York at one point. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Like one that was created by the city, and then the state created one, and then they had a huge brawl, pretty much a battle at City Hall. That the actual state-created police force ended up winning.
It sounds like now with Cuomo and de Blasio.
Yeah.
State police and the New York. Well, now after the riots, you don't see the state police within 50 miles of New York City anymore.
Sure.
Cuomo doesn't want anything getting on him, you know?
Yeah, that's a whole nother thing, man. Holy Lord, what's going on right now?
It's crazy. But, yeah, you know, you talk about the history of New York City, too. The firemen used to get in fights with each
yes.
other over who would put out the fire.
Right, right.
You know, because there was no, like, boundaries delineated.
So right.
They would get to the fire and be like, it's our fire. No, it's your fire. And they would get in big brawls.
And they would actually recruit firemen who could fight. Like, that was one of the things that they would recruit. Like, yo, this guy can really throw down. Let's get him on the fire squad so he can just beat the crap out of people. That's exactly what they would do.
Well, they would get paid for saving the building by the landlord.
Right, right. So they were, it was actually like private. So they were getting paid. And so they would basically battle it out to see who got these jobs.
If you could save the building, the landlord would tip you. Also, yeah. They used to steal whatever they could.
Yes.
So they made out on both ends. And there were street gangs.
Yeah. Well, Bill has that joke. You told me that one joke, Bill. You know the what was that joke you told me? The Batman joke?
The Batman joke?
The Batman, has he told you this joke, Mark?
You probably know that. Your friend told that joke. That was on the, was it, oh yeah, what do Batman and the fire department have in common? They won't leave an apartment without Robin.
They won't go anywhere without Robin.
Firemen hate us already. Now they're going to get some hate mail, you know?
Yeah, that was I don't know anything about it. Bill made it. Everyone get mad at Bill.
Get back to me. What's your favorite part of the city to give a tour in?
I don't know. It depends, I guess. I love the history of all the neighborhoods and all that. I think like Greenwich Village has such an incredible history. It's like really pretty and it's easy to walk around. I love walking across the bridge. That's always kind of nice. I love Central Park. Like these places are all just like, it's kind of like a joke. When you show up, you're like, this is what I have to do for a job. I'm just walking around with people who've never been here in a like amazing place and just talk to them.
But even, you know, Greenwich Village has a great history with the music.
Oh yeah,
Gertie's Folk City.
Oh yeah, yeah, Gertie's Folk. All that's but,
that, but
not
that's
just
not
music.
There anymore. That
with
was
everything.
Right next door to that McDonald's there, right? On West 3rd.
Yep. But it's not just music. They have. I mean, they have painting. They have, you know, acting. Anything cultural in New York City has gone through, you know, Greenwich Village in some way.
Yeah, it was the bohemian place to live, right?
Yeah.
I was friends with a guy down when I was performing a lot in the Village. And he used to do jazz tours.
Yeah, yeah.
So he'd bring, he'd always stop by the Boston Comedy Club, which then was the Comedy Village. But he'd stop by because there was a jazz club next door. And he'd bring the people inside, come out for a cigarette, and we'd bullshit. And I got to know the guy pretty good. And that's what he used to do. He used to bring people to all the jazz bars down there.
Yeah.
And get them in and seated and situated and...
There's still a bunch of jazz clubs. I'm not a huge jazz guy, though. I don't really like jazz that much. Does that make me crazy?
Nah.
My father loved jazz, man.
I couldn't get it.
My father used to bring me to these places to listen to jazz. And as a kid, listening to jazz fucks you up. Because it's
it's all improvisation, you know? It's improvisation.
It's so weird because every time I hear jazz, I feel like I'm like shopping for pants at Macy's or something, you know? It's like... It's just like background. Background noise, you know.
But then there's bands that integrate jazz into their rock and roll, and it makes the Allman Brothers, you know,
sure.
Marshall Tucker,
like Steely
they
Dan.
Integrated jazz into country rock, and it sounds great, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I think you're right. I don't know what it is. I feel like that's a super unpopular stance that I just took. So we'll both get hate mail.
No, people act as if they love jazz because it's like. Groovy to like jazz. I used a 60s word there. You see that? I was trying to go on a tour to
Greenwich. Want us to listen to jazz.
The word from the 60s.
When you were a kid, you shouldn't listen to jazz because you're trying to develop rhythm and you know, try to guess what the next word to a song is when you're a kid. That's how your brain works. That's why you have lullabies. And now you're listening to jazz and it fucks up your brain.
It's a PSA right here, parents. Everyone, don't have your kids listen to jazz or you're a bad parent.
When my son was in the womb, when he was being born, we were playing Pat Metheny. You know,
there you go.
Which is a very melodic jazz guitarist. So
right,
maybe
somebody tried to turn me on to jazz. They gave me the Miles Davis. It's like a 5 CD thing where he starts out and then creating this thing, and then they keep playing it every night, the thing, and it builds up, and it built for like a year, I think. And he's like, dude, this is gonna turn your life around. Mm-hmm. And it did nothing for me, man. I couldn't believe it. Was like, I get it. I understand. It's almost like watching somebody develop their 45 minutes of comedy, but it's not comedy, it's jazz.
That's a ringing endorsement right there.
Yeah, it's not for me. God bless you if you like it. I don't like country music either, so there you go.
You guys ever talk about music on this podcast? Now, is this a first?
Yeah, pretty much.
We talk about Bill's music because Bill's always singing.
Yeah.
Oh, do you play music on this podcast, Bill?
No, I never play music. Oh, sometimes I'll sing a song just to goof around, you know.
And Bill used to sing in a band.
Yeah, I played guitar with Tom on that the episode we did, right?
Yeah, we played some guitar together. We jammed.
Yeah.
We jammed to some Bob Dylan.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, no big deal. I play guitar too. Nice plug. Nice work, Bill. Thank you. I got the check in the mail to get you that.
Uh-huh. You got to be multi-talented in this world of comedy, you know?
I know, man. I know. It's a crazy grind right now, huh? Especially with no stand-up going on.
I just did a show a couple of weeks ago in Central Park, but I didn't do anything for 2 months before that, you know?
Well, those shows in the park are very odd because there's no energy, like, bottled up. It's all dissipated. You know, people are over there like, you know, throwing the frisbee or like, what am I doing? I feel like you feel like you're talking to nobody a little bit. And then people laugh, obviously, but you don't feel it as much as the performer.
It's everything. It's so weird right now. And it's like anything. It's not. I don't know what it is, but it's nothing that we're used to. But I'm so excited about just doing it that.
Yes.
I don't really think about it.
You're right. You're right.
I think about the obstacles that I just. You know, if you haven't run in a while, do you really care whether you got to run to the beach or on gravel or with, you know, shoes on? No. You got to run.
I agree. It's great to get out there and it's nice.
Friends again, mm-hmm. You know, seeing my friends again, getting the chance to do the jokes that I've written. But you talk about weird setups, man. Oh, my God. Yeah. Every show itself has its own different dynamic.
Yep.
You just have to just say, fuck it, I'm going to forge on.
Yeah.
Just jokes. Pretend like people are listening or looking at me or just pretend.
Yeah, well, we had one show I did in a yard of a hotel, and a guy who was outside of the hotel, like driving by, just parked next to basically the yard, blaring music. So he was blaring things like Blackstreet. I don't know if you guys remember like hip-hop in like the late 90s. But it's like this music just loud. People could barely hear you. And it was just there for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And so the show kept going. And then people were just like, all right, well, all right. When are you going to turn that down? And eventually he does. But that's that kind of weird stuff that you got to deal with outside.
I guess he didn't like comedy. Oh, you know what is? The show I did in Central Park, though, I got to hear Mark Norman. He was the headliner. The guy's
great. Nice.
He was, I mean, one of the best comics I've heard in a long time.
You know? Yeah, he's great. You saw it. Did you see what he did with his special? He actually released it on YouTube himself.
Is that right?
He did it at the beginning of the pandemic. It was actually pretty smart. I mean, he released it on YouTube. And so all the views or whatever just basically boosted his channel. Now he's got, you know, 100-something thousand people and following his stuff. And, you know, you make money off ads and all that stuff. It's pretty smart.
That's great. Yeah. You know, I was thinking about other tours you could do. I was thinking about the New York City Lover's Lane tour, you know, like you could go around to Lover's Lanes and then you could do the Son of Sam Lover's Lane.
Son of Sam tour. That's a real pick me up.
You know, where he shot people tour, you know, you could all different places in the city. Now you can't even do like the restaurant tour, famous restaurants, because they're all closed.
Everything's closed. But, you know, people love those food tours. And you have like pizza tours and stuff like that. I've done pizza places with everyone.
Pizza tour sounds cool, man. I like
it's
that.
Great. It's great. There's so many good spots, obviously, in Manhattan. You know, you take them like Bleecker Street Pizza. You take them up to, you know, Suprema next to Penn. There's a bunch of great places to take people.
Which is the first stop you said again?
Bleecker Street Pizza.
And John's too?
Oh, isn't Bleecker Street Pizza owned by a retired?
Yeah. It was, yeah. Yes, you're right. Nice work, dude.
He died from, I think, 9/11 cancer.
Yeah, Greenwood.
Yeah.
Jack Greenwood.
Horrible, you know.
Yeah, well, did you know him?
I didn't know him, but a guy we had on the show, Ralph Friedman, he works there like one night a week.
Oh, no way.
As security there.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Yeah, yeah.
Ralph is like a famous detective that we had on the show.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. Well, Jack Greenwood was the, he was actually in charge, I think, of the cleanup for after 9/11.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I heard.
He was in charge of the whole thing for the NYPD. And he, and then he retired after and he opened this pizzeria. And now his brother actually is one of the owners, and then his nephew as well.
Wow. You know what I was amazed at? I went by, I don't know, 6 months or a year ago, that Matt Umanoff Guitars.
Yeah.
Who was there for like 50 years, closed. I was like, what? I couldn't believe it, you know?
Yeah.
Talk about a historic store in New York City, Matt Umanoff Guitars.
Oh, well, man, you could do a whole podcast on the places that have closed in just the last 3 months, dude.
Yeah. Like,
the Gem Spa closed. Gem Spa and St. Mark's closed, where they did the, you know, the New York Dolls did their cover. You know, Madonna was there, like Basquiat. Those are all the people who used to hang out there. It closed. It's been around since like the early 1900s.
Yeah, it's sort of depressing, you know.
It is sort of depressing.
I don't know what the city's going to look like after this is over. It's going to take a long time.
Somebody had a really cavalier attitude towards it, and now Martin freaked out. I think the comic's name was Frank Vignola. And Al Martin freaked out on him because the guy was like, well, you know, these are the businesses where once used to be a comedy club, it'll be a dry cleaning, and then what used to be a this type of store will turn into a comedy club. These things happen. And it's like, you know, he freaked out. He's like, this is our lifeblood here. You know, we worked hard for these businesses. So,
yeah. Well, and also, too, the question is what businesses? Like, if they all go away and the rents stay high, what business is going to want to open? You know, it's going to be McDonald's and like, you know, and 7-Elevens. So right. that's the scary thing to me. The scary thing.
No, but the big corporate stores.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean. So like these, yeah. So these big corporate stores who can take these huge hits,
right?
Can open, and then all the mom and pop stores that actually make New York interesting are the ones that, you know, are gone for good. You know.
But I think the politicians have to be a little more respectful of people in this city that have money that leave. They diss them all the time. Like, oh, you know, you better come back. We need your money. Maybe they won't come back because you disrespect the shit out of them, you know?
Yeah, I guess. How do you mean they disrespect them?
Well, they act by taxing their balls off.
Oh,
you
right.
Know, and saying, well, you know, we're going to tax the shit out of you when you come back because we need you to. Look, it's the same theory between what I feel is they stopped prosecuting jumping the turnstiles. Mm-hmm. So people are with impunity jumping the turnstiles. But guess what? Now the MTA is like $8 billion in the red, you know, because they're not forcing people to pay. And you know what their answer to that is? Congestion pricing. They're going to make the people coming in from the suburbs that drive a car, they're going to tax the shit out of you to drive below a certain street.
What they didn't realize is that we're going to get hit with the COVID.
Right.
And there's no reason to drive into the city. So your whole congestion pricing thing is going to generate cock.
And then they just put 2,000 speed cameras all along the city. Another way to fuck the person that makes money, you know, that pays taxes.
You know? Yeah. Well, you know what, though, too? Another thing to consider, though, is that, like, the city also gives – there's a lot of subsidies given to people with lots of money, too. Like, there's a lot of free – like, tax breaks given to these giant companies and developers for opening luxury buildings. That, to me, is what makes me the maddest. Like, a turnstile jumper, fine. But like that's like a buck, $275. Give someone like a, you know, $100 million tax break. That's a lot of turnstile jumpers.
But if you get tens of thousands of turnstile jumpers at the end of the year, it's $1 billion. You know.
That's true, but it's interesting because a lot of these like tax breaks. You look at like the tax breaks. These things date back to when the city was really in the hole in the '70s,
right.
And these tax breaks were put in place to rejuvenate the city and bring it back. And so you have in like 2010, 2015, when the city was doing just fine. These developers are taking advantage of the same tax breaks and right. The city isn't getting any of that money for decades, if any. Mm-hmm. So that's just like the same kind
Except
of thing.
That at the same time, they chased that big corporate company that was coming into Queens.
Amazon.
Yeah. They chased them away.
Yeah.
You know, and they also had that tax break for, I guess it's a fair market value. So you can hold out on renting your store until you get, the whatever people are getting in the neighborhood. So you have these huge spaces.
Yes, yes.
And you're taking a loss on it, but you really, when you take a loss, you have an empty space you don't have to pay taxes on, and you're taking a loss, so you're cutting your taxes on your other properties that are that you have tenants in.
Right.
So it's this whole big scam, and you have all these spaces. This was before the COVID.
Yes.
You have all these huge spaces, like you take a Dwayne Reed, what used to be a Dwayne Reed, and now this space has been open on 53rd and 2nd Avenue for about 3 years now.
Well, what you're saying is a huge problem. So they call this actually, they call it in these neighborhoods, they call it luxury blight. So you have neighborhoods like Greenwich Village, Soho, these neighborhoods that are extremely expensive, and you have businesses that close, like mom and pops, because they can't pay the rent. Even if they were successful, they can't pay the rent. So then the landlord, what it does is because the rents are going up, they basically bet that the rent's going to continue to rise, and then they pin the rent at like a higher level than what the market wants. Basically betting that someone's going to come in eventually and then lock themselves into a lease at a higher price. And in doing that, they're basically keeping these vacancies there. And that's damaging the neighborhood. The people who live there who have money are angry. The people who visit are angry. Everyone is, it's just ruining the neighborhood. And the person who's going to move in eventually is going to be a 7-Eleven anyway. So it's going to ruin the neighborhood in the long run as well. So it's just kind of like one of the actual, it's almost like the victim of prosperity. These neighborhoods are the victim of prosperity as long as the city doesn't do something about things like that.
I like that saying, victim of prosperity.
Well, yeah. They say that's the problem too with rent stabilization, is that building owners warehouse apartments because they don't want to, you know, they don't want to rent it again at a stabilization rate. And they claim they're losing money, and they think, you know, they'll hope that the law will change. But I don't know if that's going to happen.
Well, now, especially now where you got like 38,000 rental apartments available and people bailing out of co-ops like crazy.
Yeah, and they're still building and they're finishing condo buildings right now, which is nuts.
Yeah, this is a big problem.
Yeah, who knows what's going to happen with these things.
Where do you live?
I live in Ridgewood, Queens.
Oh, cool, man.
It's a great neighborhood. I've been there for like a year and a half, a year and a half. It's good. I lived in Bushwick before that. Then I lived in Greenpoint before that.
You've been very nomadic in just the 3 or 4 years I've known you.
Yeah, Bill, just so you know, Bill, Mark, I'm sorry, just so you know, Mark, Bill likes to make fun of me for always posting stuff about when I'm moving.
Yeah.
So I think he's trying to bust my balls again. Here we go, Bill. Yeah, no, I have moved a bunch. But yeah,
Do you have roommates now, or you?
I do have roommates. It's a very rare thing to be a former lawyer with roommates in my mid-30s.
Holy shit!
But it's okay.
I'm looking at all those books, and I'm like, fuck! If you got to move again, then those books must be tough.
Well, first of all, this actually isn't my apartment. This isn't my apartment. I actually had a friend's apartment. It's like a very nice, like Soho loft. My apartment is not this nice, just so you know. Disclaimer for sure.
Because those books could be like, I'm like, yeah, you need to get one of those. Those things, not the iPad, where you put your
pods.
That thing that you put your books in there.
Oh yeah, the Kindle.
Yeah, you got to get a Kindle, bro. Those books are a pain in the ass to keep.
I can't do Kindle, man. I have to read an actual solid book. I hate it, but I can't do the Kindle. I get distracted too easily.
I have a Kindle, and I downloaded like 3 books. Never cracked them. They're good books.
Of course, it's not the same experience, man. I don't know what it is. The Kindle doesn't work for me.
We get sent books all the time. In fact, Mark has been sent as many books as me, and he hasn't read one of them yet. we have authors coming on that want to be, hey, did you read my book? Oh, fuck. I'm going to read it. I just haven't got around.
He's like, I'm halfway through the back cover.
That's right. I read the prologue so far.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a periodicals guy. You know, I'm up to date. I'm pretty much, you know, in news and stuff like that. So I read a lot, but I'm just not as far as fiction. I prefer fiction, but nonfiction.
Sure, I like to read both, but nonfiction I prefer. And you know, the nice thing though, that's the nice thing about living out in Ridgewood. I live 10 stops out of Manhattan, so I'll sit on the subway and just crack a book open. It makes the time blow by. It's great.
You're such an intellectual.
I know. It really is nice.
You're on the subway reading a book.
It's only
Tolstoy,
a story.
War and Peace, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's empty, but I have the cover, and people are just looking at me.
Solzhenitsyn, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. You know,
it's all about the perception, Bill. People have to know.
The coffin, quiet flows the Don. You know.
that's my bookcase behind me.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
It's all plays.
It's all plays and hats.
Well, yeah, but there's a lot of plays in there and like autobiographies. Those are the things, not autobiographies, autobiographies, those kind of things. Like,
sure.
Especially, they're all old books too, like from when I was, you know, really doing a lot of plays and studying acting, and then it's also comedy books. Those things I'll read.
Since it's your podcast, I'm going to turn into podcast host for a second. What are your two guys' favorite books?
I don't know. I like crime books. You know, I like to read about.
Which one? What's your favorite one?
I just read this one actually.
Oh wow!
About the mafia cops, Ippolito and Caracappa.
Oh okay.
And because we were trying to get one of the detectives from the case to come on the show, but these guys took part in like anywhere between 8 and 14 murders, and a couple
the cops?
Of them, yeah.
Whoa.
A couple of them actually did, you know, themselves. They both got life in prison, but they both have died since. They both died in prison. But they were like two of the dirtiest cops of all time.
Wow, that's messed up.
Yeah, it was pretty messed up. Yeah.
Well, there you go. So that's your favorite book?
Well, not my favorite, but I like to read about crime.
Oh, okay.
Like that, you know.
What about you, Mark? What's your favorite book?
I was hoping you'd skip past me. Like I said, I'm not much of a reader. I remember I really enjoyed Charles Grodin's book. I Wish You Weren't Here. Did you ever read that?
No, I didn't read that.
He's a good writer. I've read those type of books about comedians or actors and stuff like that. But I am kind of sort of like a movie buff. Like I know I've watched a lot of old movies, studied them. And things like that. You know what I'm saying?
So if you see a book you like, you're just like, I'm just going to wait until this gets made into a movie.
No, I just couldn't even tell you like this. If I go to a store, the store, there you go.
The general store.
You know, one of those stores that sells books. What are those called?
Libraries.
Yeah. It's all very specific. Uh-huh. Put it this way, back in the day before the internet and stuff like that, when you needed to know, like if I wanted to know when I first started bodybuilding, right? You know, I was 17, 18 years old. So, of course, I bought Arnold's encyclopedia. Then I bought every book that I could read because you couldn't go on the internet. There was no internet to look stuff up. So you had to read. So that whatever I was into at the time, I would read a lot about, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's the crazy thing, I think, with the internet now in 15 years, we'll be talking about books like they were 8-tracks.
Yeah.
You
know what I read that I thought was really interesting was I read Keith Richards' biography.
Oh, wow, really?
And I also read Greg Allman. And,
oh, cool. But
the funny thing is, I mean, as talented as they are, you realize what narcissists, musicians.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's like no one else exists except them. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Of course.
Especially Greg Allman. It seemed like he could give a fuck about anyone else but himself. That was just his whole, I mean, he was married to Cher. He even said, she sucks as a singer. And he told her that to her face. You don't know how to sing, you know?
I always wonder about that. You're onto something, I think. Like the idea of these people who are so famous like that. I feel like you don't become that famous by accident. Like that's something that you have to have. Like it's like breathing to these people. They wake up and every decision is made to become that famous, you know?
Right,
so you
right.
might be right. Like it's just this insane superhuman level of narcissism.
Can I explain it to you?
Sure.
We reach every day, we make decisions.
Right.
And if you're one of these people that when you're making a decision, you think to yourself, how would this impact others? Then you're probably never going to reach that level of fame.
Yes. Right.
Because every decision that you make, you never think about anybody else. It's always, and anybody else who's in the way of you reaching that particular goal in the meantime is expendable. It doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, the guy, he used to write jokes for all the Oscars. Valanche was his last name.
Oh, Bruce Valanche.
Bruce Valanche.
An encyclopedia.
They asked him one time, because he knows all these celebrities really well. And he says, what's the difference between an A-list celebrity and like a B-list celebrity? And he said, the A-list celebrities have no idea that anybody else exists.
That's great.
True.
That you have to have, like a blind, you know, tunnel vision.
Yeah.
And you live in that zone. And kind of, it's amazing, but just that attitude to be like that, you'll get people hanging on.
Yeah.
you believe in your vision. Hope, anyway. Otherwise,
no, you're right.
Otherwise, you're just a crazy person. You have to have some type of talent to go with it.
I don't know, man. I think these days, especially, it's easier. It's getting easier to convince people you have talent when you might not necessarily have it. You know.
Well, the Kardashians.
Yeah, I mean, you got like reality TV. There's all the social media stuff. You just build a following. You know.
It's specific, though. It's you have to have something that people want to watch.
Right, but that can be like trash. You can make trash.
Whatever it is, it's just there's a thousand videos on every single thing, but for some reason there's one person that sticks out more than the others, and that person gets the most views.
Yeah, well, sometimes it's that person's ability to crack the code and their ability to repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat and just be in your face.
Yeah, whatever it is, it's that's a talent in itself. You know, I was talking
to
a comedian about having to perform with these internet stars now, which is something I come across, but he does a lot of road work, and how they don't have the time on stage.
Right.
They got like 10 minutes, 12 minutes, but they're booked as the headliner.
Right.
So they're always asked to, to fill in or do time or help out a little bit extra. And, you know, the attitude becomes at some point, nah, fuck him. He's getting the big money. Let him do his freaking time, you know, or them, let them do their time. But it's a different animal.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Popular on the internet or being an internet comedian.
Yeah.
And stand up. Nobody really respects like stand up as an art form until they have to do it.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's like, oh, in between my acting gigs right now, things are getting slow. I'll start doing stand up.
Mm-hmm.
And their name draws people in, but they don't really have. They don't have the material.
Right.
Yeah.
But they don't care really because we go back to that narcissism thing.
Mark, how about even the trend of having porn stars doing comedy? I don't know what they were really like. Stormy Daniels, she was on tour doing comedy. But there was really no comedy. I don't know what she actually did.
Well, what they do, it's like anyone else. Like they book these people at comedy clubs because they'll fill the seats, period. Right. And they show up, they go up there and they talk about their cab ride to the place, you know, for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And they let the feature and the host do the heavy lifting. And then afterwards they sign autographs and take pictures. That's what people go for.
Right.
Like these people from the internet, like these TikTok and all these people, they're like, a lot of them are going to, you know, comedy clubs and they sell out or whatever, but you know, sometimes they don't have the time or whatever, but I don't know. I mean, that's also, I don't know. That's the business of the comedy clubs. They have to fill the seats too, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It is what it is.
Yeah.
I think some of the best shows in comedy are not in the clubs.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, like you had a show, a bar show.
Yeah.
Oco on Thursday. That was a great show.
Yeah. You know? It was fun.
And that's not a comedy club. It's you and your partner running the show and doing a great job. Right.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully it'll come back. That's something I actually do miss a little bit. But we got to do it too at like the Bowery Ballroom and got to do some cooler venues and whatnot. And you know, you just kind of work on it. We did it for like 4.5 years, so it took a little time. Yeah.
What's the name of the show?
The show is called Let's See What Else. And the place was called Poco in the East Village. It was on 3rd and B.
3rd Avenue B, that's right.
Yeah.
He actually put me on the show a few times.
Yeah, you did it
one time. One time, the whole front of the audience was loaded with millennials, and I did all my millennial material.
The first thing,
millennials are pieces of shit. Yeah.
The first thing Bill did was when he got on stage, he just started making fun of millennials. They're like, "Who brought their crazy uncle here? What's going on?"
They're like, "Who is this guy?" Yeah. They're like, "You millennials are the worst pieces of shit in the history of this country." You know?
Yeah.
But no, did you think about this, but have you been getting up lately?
A little bit, yeah. I've been doing some of the park shows, some of the like little, there's one that was really fun. It's a hotel in Brooklyn and they do like the rooftop shows and stuff. I've been doing a few here and there, but to be quite honest, it's hard to get into the flow of it, not doing it as much as before, you know?
Yeah.
Talking about the Eastville?
No, there was another one. It's this guy, he runs it at this hotel in Bushwick. Right off of Broadway there, and is in the yard there. That was a fun one.
Yeah.
Hotel RL.
Yeah. Eastville does a show there too.
Yes, they do. You're right.
I did that one. That was nice. There was a couple of shows that I've done that have actually been very, very close to.
Yeah.
You wouldn't really tell the difference. The only thing is a little that it's not as crowded and the seats are a little bit more separated. But I've been fortunate to do some like what seems like normal shows.
Yeah.
Those, but
no. And that,
when you write new stuff and you haven't been getting up to practice it to see if it works, you're a little reluctant to try it, right?
Yeah, I agree 100%. That's exactly what I was talking about. It's hard to get into the groove of stand-up again because you don't have a place to try out the stuff you want to talk about.
Right.
So you're not really writing new stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you just kind of got to get up more often.
So I've written some stuff, but I haven't tried it in front of a live audience.
Right.
You know,
and then when you finally get the opportunity, you don't want to try it because you don't want to waste that like precious opportunity doing new stuff the whole time. So you're like, all right.
You're stuck in a hole because you got this new stuff that is basically that one joke that you have. And what you do is when you have that one joke, you're going to do it on stage a couple of times. And all the other ones that you think might be good too, you'll try those on, you'll add those like barnacles, and you'll keep building up on that one joke that you had until it's a bit.
Yeah.
You don't have that opportunity. So you just have that one joke.
Yep.
So you're doing that one, and then you're doing another one, and then you're doing another one, and you're going out, you're going really, literally going through 5 or 6 premises in 10 minutes.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? That are eventually could be bits, but you don't have a chance to work them out. Or you could do old stuff, which you don't remember.
That's true too, right? Yeah. Because you don't have the rhythm. You don't have the rhythm of connecting the jokes, right? That's how you remember is connecting the jokes to different jokes, right?
Yeah, the old ones, you don't want it. You don't feel like doing them. But I just ripped through 6 new jokes. And the other day I had to do 45 minutes, which was – that was pretty interesting, you know. And just every single setup is different. It's like for 30 guys that are in front of me. And then it's streaming to like 280 other people somewhere else. Because last year I did it, and it was 500 people in a VFW. And this year they can't all be together. So we did a 30 dudes. So you're performing for 30 guys. And that's one set of material. But you also got to be conscious of the fact that there's 280 other people that paid to watch this.
Right.
They're at home. So like, how do you, like, I don't know how they're reacting to this chauvinistic thing just to get these drunk guys to keep laughing. And then plus, if you're interacting with somebody or they're heckling, you have to repeat their part for the people at home.
Right.
Otherwise, what you're saying makes no sense. Oh, he just said this right now. So now, blah, blah, blah. And then, oh, he just said this right now.
Yeah.
People actually commented afterwards. They're like, wow, that was pretty good the way you let the people at home know what the other guy said.
No, that was smart. That was smart to do.
Respond to this guy if they can't hear him.
Yeah.
It's like someone asking a question from the audience and the audience can't hear the question, right?
Right.
They don't know what the hell he's asking.
Right. Well, then there's also, at least you have some live people in that because you get at least like live feedback. When you do the Zoom shows, it's even.
Oh, yeah, they're tough. They're really
it's
tough.
Even tougher because you get, I mean, like a lot of times you get nothing.
Right.
You have to pretend.
Yeah, you and just kind of.
Pretend. A lot of it is acting. You know, you're working on your timing. You know what it's like to do the joke, to deliver the joke. So you just do it and you pretend like, and you give the pause and the beat for the laughter. You know, I did a Zoom show. And Judah Friedlander was on it. And we had a pretty decent audience. I think it was like 21 people or 25 people watching. So you got all the little boxes. And he was doing crowd work, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had their volumes up so he can ask them, where are you from? What do you do? And then, you know, he was doing crowd work. And he did crowd work for like 30, 40 minutes on a Zoom show. It was amazing. That was one of the better ones.
That's his whole MO, though, is doing crowd work even
in
live, right? That's what he does. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of his act is doing crowd work, but I mean, he's not doing, they're not, it's an illusion. They're jokes. He has jokes.
Yeah, he has like things prepared for everything.
Leads them into believing that it's crowd work, but you're leading them into a joke.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing everyone's hoping for is that pretty soon clubs will be open again and, you know, rooms will be able to exist again and whatnot. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I don't know about that, man, because this whole old indoor thing, what I think is going to happen is you're going to have a lot of outdoor venues with heating, the tents, which will be fine.
You know something? It's really expensive to use those propane heaters. Those things cost. Well, I have one in my yard. That goes through, like, if you use it for a bunch of hours, it goes through like a tank of propane, like you wouldn't believe, you know?
How much is a tank of propane?
Like $22,
$25. Oh, okay.
You know? So if the venue has to have four or five of those, just think of how much, you know, it costs a lot of money, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, we'll see, man. I don't know. I mean, we'll see how long all this lasts. It would be nice to be able to just perform regularly again.
Yeah.
We got bikes right now. The Hasids, they don't want to fucking follow any rules. God bless them. You see arguing in the street with them? Show me the numbers. I want to see the numbers. I go to the hospital every single day. I don't know what you're talking about.
So what is it I should wear a mask for?
Yeah. I got tested positive in the morning and negative in the afternoon. What are you talking about? Show me. You know the video, Tom, what we're talking about?
I haven't seen it, no.
It's a Hasid. He's in Brooklyn, and he's supposedly some type of activist. So they're trying to do a press conference, and he interrupts it, and he starts asking questions. But he's not really asking the question. He's asking the question and talking. And they keep trying to interrupt him. No, wait. And the guy, whoever's talking behind the mask, he keeps saying, no, let him go. Just let him go. I think he's going to run out of steam, but the guy won't. It's great. It's
oh, fun. Man, that's great.
So New York. It's so Hasid. It's so New York, man. You know, that's another interesting tour, man. You take them to see the Sids.
Oh yeah. I mean, whenever I'm in Williamsburg, I'll pop in a little bit to South Williamsburg and show people how different it is down there.
You tell them this is our Amish.
Yeah. It's a different world over there for sure.
He's a Jewish Amish. Jewish Amish. I love them, man. I love how insulated they are. I love that they don't really have to, I admire that. I think there needs to be more of that. Everybody needs, you know, one of the things where I grew up, my New York, was people went.
You grew up in the Bronx, Mark?
I grew up in Queens, in Astoria. But people went to work and they did all their dealings with, whichever other race they had to deal with. But then when they went home to their borough, wherever they lived in a neighborhood that was predominantly theirs. So they were almost like, you went to Astoria, you were Greek, you know what I'm saying, or Italian. Then if you went to Woodside, you were Irish. If you went to Elmhurst, you were Spanish. So you didn't have so much dealings with it. It was just at work. And you could behave yourself. You could hold on to it long enough before you started motherfucking like every other – you know what I'm saying? You waited – like my grandfather got home and took off his shoes and put on the news. That's when he'd start. Oh, look at these fucking monkeys. You know what I'm saying? Look at these fucking – you know, cursing everybody out, you know, but he saved it all day until he got home and fucking cursed the TV out and all the crime and that's old New York right there. Archie Bunkers, George Jefferson's.
Well, let me ask you something. And Tom, you're a smart guy, and I know you're more of the liberal persuasion. Why do ethnic groups and racial groups seek to live with their own people?
Well, I think what you're talking about, especially when it comes to immigrants, that's a pretty like easy one, I'd say, only because when you're coming into another country, you want to like ease into the country too, you know? So like, and if you look at any of the big, like Little Italy, you know, Chinatown, the big Elmhurst, you're talking about these neighborhoods that are predominantly one group. Those are all either recently arrived people or people who came in mass.
Well, Little Italy really doesn't exist.
No, it doesn't. I'm talking about historically, back in the day.
Yeah, for sure.
But when it did exist, it was created because people were coming all at once. And they wanted to arrive and kind of figure things out a little more easily. Like they didn't know the language. They needed people to help find them jobs and places to live. They knew somebody. It was all kind of organically created. And I think you still kind of have that. Like you have this like comfort. You have this sense of like, you know, of being able to kind of be yourself and have more. Like even now, for example, in Chinatowns, a lot of the other Asian countries go to the Chinatowns to live, even though they're not Chinese, because they feel more at home there. So like Koreans.
Well, there's an area of Queens, the 109 precinct. It's all Asians.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a couple of Chinatowns
there's still some neighborhood, like Washington Heights, Dominicans.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So yeah, if you go to the Heights, there's a good chance that, you know, some of the Dominicans just got here.
Right. Or in Elmhurst, you were talking about Elmhurst. That's a lot of the Mexican population. I mean, Mexicans are the fastest growing ethnicity in New York City right now. And a lot of them live out there in Elmhurst because there's other Mexicans there. I mean, you go to like Corona Park, go to Corona, like over there at Flushing Meadows Park. If you go over there, like on a weekend, it's all Mexican people. It's all Latin American, Central American people just, you know, playing their volleyball and hanging out. You think you're in a different country. It's a pretty amazing thing.
No, it is. They cheat at volleyball, though. They don't do the right to dig. You know how you're supposed to do
Yeah.
They do this.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
The ball. I want to go in there like a referee. They're not allowed to do that in this country. Maybe
they man.
You have to do the correct dig or else it's no good.
Oh, boy. This is turning into a volleyball police off the cuff.
And
right. You know what I'm talking about. You've seen that.
I do know what you're talking about, actually.
Brighton Beach with the Russians.
Yeah, Brighton Beach with the Russians. I was just there like a week ago. It's a pretty awesome place.
Polish people in Greenport.
Well, yeah, Polish people in
Greenpoint.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, but it also depends on the time and history you're at. Like what groups are coming in, you know?
And then you have small segments too, like in one area. So for example, in Astoria, if you go by 36th Avenue, it's all Brazilian. From 31st Street up to Steinway Street, you can get really great.
Long tan and young and lovely, the girl for me. I'm sorry.
See, didn't I warn you?
You him. How can I tell her I love her?
Oh, boy. Have you ever been to
Brazil? Every guitar player knows that song. You know that song.
Right? I went to Brazil. That was
been to Brazil?
Yeah.
It's a pretty awesome place.
Yeah, I was a kid, though, man. We were like 19 years old, and we probably shouldn't have went to another country. We got locked up.
Don't tell me you gave a tour of Rio.
Yeah, yeah, that's my next stop. That's my next
tour of the Rio jails. That's what I got.
Yeah, the favelas.
Yeah, man, we got into like a couple of because we were like I grew up in Astoria, so we got into a couple of fist fights over there, and we got chased, and it was interesting. It was interesting.
Wait, you went to Brazil just like on vacation? You got arrested?
Yeah, me and my three friends from Astoria.
Whoa, what happened? Where's the story here? This sounds interesting.
We just, everybody was going to one, we went to spring break the year before in Fort Lauderdale. And the year after that, we just decided we wanted to do something different. So we went to Brazil. Don't ask me why.
Wow.
And we realized we're going to another country and here we are. We got these big fucking chains and nugget jewelry ready to go out. And everybody was like, no, bandidos, fuck them, you know? And we turned around, we brought the shit back. They don't fuck around over there, man. They'll kill you. They'll cut your head off.
Wait, so what happened? So they try to rob you?
Well, yeah, they try to rob us. They try to set us up. A lot of things happening. We got into a fight on the beach over a chair.
An actual fist fight?
Yeah. We got jumped.
What?
Grounded, yeah. But don't forget, too, man, you know what the funny thing is like everybody knew we weren't from there for some reason. So one night we got dressed up and we're walking to this bar, and it's an outdoor bar. And just the way we were walking, everybody stopped and they fucking looked. Like, who are these guys? Like, and, you know what I'm saying? And we didn't know the language. It was a big, you know, the best part of life is mistakes. You know what I'm saying?
That's, when everything's perfect
and everything is comfortable, you're never going to remember it. Yeah. When everything is fucked up, you can remember every detail.
That's true. That is true.
As long as you walk away from the mistakes unscathed. If you walk away with a knife sticking out of your neck, that mistake wasn't so fun.
Well said, Bill.
Yeah. Whenever you got a shiv in your neck, things didn't turn out too good for you.
Yeah, I think that's a bumper sticker somewhere.
Yeah.
Mom said, don't go anywhere. A knife could wind up sticking out of your neck.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, Bill. Maybe you should take a trip to Rio, Bill.
I don't know. I heard the police there, when they catch robbers, they just shoot them in the alleyway.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah, that's what I heard. They don't mess around in Brazil.
Well, I would imagine if you got money on you, it's always about money. You know, one time they took us in this little it was like a military out, like a little, like, it looked like a police station, but it was more like a hut. And that's where the soldiers, you know, would go and do their paperwork, I guess. Mm. And they were writing shit in the sand. We want $1,000 a piece from you. And I'm like, we're leaving in 2 days. We don't have $1,000 anymore. So we all had to give them like $100 a piece. There was four of us. So it was like $400. Somebody had to go to the fucking room to go get it. bring it back. Otherwise, they weren't going to release us.
So you got, wow, so the police got money from you, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they do. In the, like, so my parents are Nicaraguan, and we go visit family all the time over there. And I've seen it multiple times. They'll pull you over because they know you're not from there. The cars have rental things or whatever. And they basically come up to your window and they'll take your driver's license.
Yeah.
And to get it back, you have to pay $100. It's like, I have to have my license to fly out of this country. You know, I need my license back. So, right. Or passport or whatever. So you're basically bribing you.
People don't realize, you know, you want to defund the police and you want to get, everybody's going to have a different type of security in the neighborhood. That's what it's going to become.
Who knows? I mean, I don't know. That's whole thing.
Exactly what happens to these places. They used to, a lot of them had a country and they had law and order, and then they abandon it to follow some different type of form of government, and then they lose the benefit of having law and order, and that's what steps in. And some of these countries have law and order, but it's disguised as law and order, but it's really just corruption. You know, you get to pay.
I mean, it's a weird thing going on in those countries too, because everyone is just so poor and everyone's so desperate, including the police officers. So it's just like complete free for all. Everyone's just going out to get what they can, you know?
Yeah. Listen, if you live in a place and you're watching, all these people with money driving around, you can either join the group or you can live poor, and eventually they're going to kill you. Cause you want, so.
You gotta build the wall.
Oh no. Oh no.
You know what's the ironic thing is that they build a wall around Mexico, and Mexicans are the best wall builders in the world. No one builds better walls than Mexicans.
Here we go. Mark just ducked out for that. Mark just ducked out immediately after that.
I just had to try that joke again. I used to tell that joke a long time.
I'm so fascinated by these New York tours because I'm thinking to myself, what can I do from, you know, I just lost. Here's something that's really funny. I worked in the police academy as an actor, and I used to do.
Intervention. Yeah.
It was a great job. So now we lost the gig. It got defunded. The irony is none of the cops lost their job. Just all the actors, which I'm the only retired guy. All the other ones are just actors and the clinicians. So the people that they defunded had nothing to, you're not cutting into the police payroll at all, really. There's still the same amount of cops. Right. You just got rid of all the civilians. Doesn't fucking make any sense.
Well, but that's the thing they always say. The cops need more training, but then they won't pay for it. You know what I mean? And to train cops, you got to take them off the road. So now to give them training, you got to stay off of patrol for 8 hours, 10 hours, 2 days. 5 days, whatever it is, they're not willing to do that, you know.
You know, I had this idea. I thought to myself, you know, if you really think about it, law enforcement is like a blue collar job, and then now what we want to take away substance abuse, homelessness, and EDPs, emotionally disturbed people. We want to take them away from the police and have social workers dealing with it, which is fine. No cops really want to do those jobs anyway. But now, so what are you going to do? You're cutting into the police budget to hire academics. That's all you're really doing. So, and now to get these academics around, you're going to have to, first when the radio call comes over, somebody's going to deal that it's a nonviolent situation. Who's going to do that? The 911 operator? No. They're going to send a squad car there. They're going to find out what happened. Oh, this is a nonviolent situation. You can call over the clinician. Who's going to bring the clinician? It's going to be another squad car.
Yeah.
Two cops are going to come and babysit the clinician while they're fucking doing their paperwork and asking their questions. So now you just wasted four cops to to pay one clinician. And they're going to need like 5,000-6,000 clinicians.
Yeah.
You took away from the cops budget so we can pay academics to be on the city's teat. And you're really just increasing the workload double, triple the amount. So good luck. Go have it.
Yeah. I mean, there's also the taking that money and putting it into existing institutions, whether it's mental health institutions, all these things that don't have as much money as well. They're already there and they have their structure. They just need a little bit more help. That would be, I guess, another possibility. Obviously, you could have create these separate positions that are sent in with the police, but there's also existing institutions that could use a little bit.
After the fact, after we deem that this person needs some type of treatment, then they're going to go through that route, what you're talking about. So you can build up those two, but don't forget, you know, you're not really cutting down. You're never going to cut down on the amount of cops, because at some point, you know, look, it's just where we're at right now. And we're really not that low on numbers yet. You know, but also, too, don't forget, it's a way of getting money out of the federal government to basically pay for your police departments. Mm-hmm. These cities, they want to trim the municipality so they have more access to the budget. So why not get the federal government to give us money for our police department? Because now if this guy Trump wins, he's going to give you money to fix up your city, but he's going to give it to you in a thing where most of it's going to go to hiring police officers. That's the way you're going to get the money.
Well, you know what it is? It's also efficiency, because like when you talk about EDPs and mostly disturbed people, they have cops bringing these EDPs to the hospital, and then the cop has to sit with the EDP sometimes for 8 or 10 hours till the doctor decides to admit this guy or not admit him. But so think of what a waste of manpower that is, you know?
Well, who's going to deem him violent? Right. Who's going to deem the person violent? You know, the best story, Tom, these are the best stories you ever hear in your life. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's the you bring an emotionally disturbed person to the hospital, and then you bring them inside the room to meet the doctor. And then you always get this one doctor. They usually knew, by the way. They look a lot like you. And they always go
to you as like a compliment.
They always go like this. A young, handsome doctor, but with the little long hair. He's still, you know, he's still a little radical. You know, he's still wet behind the ears. And he'll go to you, officer, don't worry about him. You can uncuff him. You don't have to stay in the room. And the officer will always go, are you sure? And then the doctor will go, yes. So you uncuff him, you leave the room. 5 minutes later, you hear this.
Help me!
Help! And all you hear is boom, 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 ow, ooh, ow, ooh, help!
Yeah, they didn't teach me that in medical school.
No, you're right. I mean, I think one of the things that gets lost, though, is, I mean, there are some people who are saying, you know, abolish and all this, but I think a big part of the conversation has to do with diverting funds or just thinking about places where there's help needed as well that contribute to crime, that contribute to inequality, that contribute to these problems that aren't being addressed. Whereas, you know, the police force, let's say, is getting a lot where it could be getting less, and these other places still need some as well because they're also contributing.
Well, I'll tell you this. A lot of people think that all this stuff, because it's the first time the general public is hearing about this, but CIT, for example, crisis intervention tactics, that's something that was developed. It's a three-prong approach. The officers come to training, they learn about different types of mental illness, and in the afternoon, they get involved in a scenario where they actually have to deal and identify what type of mental illness they're dealing with. All this is so you don't shoot the person. Those are the two prongs. The third prong was supposed to be what I mentioned earlier, where at some point you're going to have a clinician, whether it's a borough clinician who's going to sit in the borough and wait for calls that are nonviolent for an emotionally disturbed person, substance abuse or homelessness, and you're going to bring the clinician there. The third part never got any traction. I don't know whether it was legally, they couldn't figure out who would be responsible if this person got hurt, God forbid, or whatever it was, that third part never got initiated. Maybe they were holding it for this situation. You know what I'm saying? Maybe they were holding it for a bigger thing, but the idea was what I just told you, a three-prong approach. And the last one never got installed.
Yeah.
Well, it's just like some genius was talking about sending social workers to shootings, you know, the shooting, after the shooting occurred. So then they called them violence interrupters. You know what they would be? They would be shooting victim interrupters. That's what they would be, not violence interrupters. I mean, whoever thought of that idea has to have the brain the size of a parakeet's ass. You know, I mean, just a moron.
Well,
you know, let's send some violence interrupters to a shooting, you know?
In all fairness, you know, a lot of people don't realize the different dynamics of different, like, neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So you could even talk to somebody who's a New Yorker and they live in Midtown or they live in the Village. And then you're trying to explain to them the mentality of what it's like to live in the projects and how your next door neighbor stole your work boots and how you saw your next door neighbor wearing your work boots. You know, you left them in front of your door so they could dry off. And now you see them and they're like, yo, those are my boots. And he's like, nah, man. So you call the cops and then the guy tells the cops, because this happened to me. Nah, I saw him in the hallway, man. I thought somebody threw him out. Well, where? This person's door. And he's like, I don't know, man. It was just laying around. So I'm like, you know, could you mind giving them back because they use so much for work? Like, I'm trying to, like be like Solomon in this story right now so I don't have to arrest this guy for stealing the next door neighbor's shoes. And they said, this is the kind of mentality that you're dealing with. And a lot of people don't understand. And I'm giving you like a very mild story of stupidity right now.
Yeah, but Mark, then the rule of the street is the guy whose boots were taken, he's got to cut this guy.
Yeah, I mean, the guy was...
he's got to do something or else he's a punk.
The guy was trying very, very hard not to do that.
Right, right.
You know what I'm saying? He wanted to hurt this guy really bad, but also, you know, he had his own family there and stuff like that. He didn't want problems with his neighbor. And we got the boots back, but it's like, you're talking about stupidity, man. It just, you can't imagine the stupidity and just the asinine things people will do to each other in living in those. Yeah.
It's just like, we talked about this a million times. You go to a shooting and a guy's wounded and you go, what'd the guy look like? I don't deal with the police. I'm going to take care of it myself. You know how many times we've heard that over our police career? I'm going to take care. Don't take care of yourself. We get paid. We'll take care of it for you. No. I don't do that. I don't rat. Snitches get stitches, that whole philosophy, you know? So you're going to shoot him and then you're going to get caught and you're going to do, you know, 5 to 10 in upstate, you know, instead of letting the police take care of it, you know.
Or you know, the stupid reasons why people get killed is a tough thing to get grasp, you know, to wrap your hands around. You know what I'm saying? You would think that your life is worth more or that you're not going to die in this fashion. I used to do a story about in my one man show about how this guy died over broccoli. There was an argument over the Chinese guy putting the broccoli in the wok with no gloves on. The girl was pregnant. She calls her boyfriend upstairs because the guy was mean to her. He comes down. He's arguing with the Chinese guy. The Mexican guy left and made the rude comment. Now this other guy who happens to be like a neighborhood icon, some coach, you know, that fucking coach kids forever. He's like, relax. I was here. It's no big deal. Shut the fuck up, man. Ah, man, you don't have to talk to me like that. Boom. Kills him.
Wow. Where was that? Chinatown? What you're saying?
No, it was in Harlem.
Oh, shit.
It was over broccoli. Well, there's no rhyme or reason to, you'd think that, you know, the way you're going to die is going to have more meaning, more romance to it. You know what I'm saying? And a lot of it.
No, you're right. I mean, you're right. Listen, it's not an easy thing for sure. I mean, I definitely agree with you. I think like there's a lot of nuances and things going on in neighborhoods and things that cops do. I do think though, one thing is that a lot of aspects that create, let's say, the criminal environments, like you're talking about people being ignorant or whatever, these are things that are rooted in, let's say, you know, substance abuse problems, education problems, you know, single parent homes. I mean, there's a million things going on in these neighborhoods that could also be addressed as well. And I guess the discussion is coming from that place. It's like, where could we put funds and kind of spread them around a little bit more so it's not just like...
Because you're talking about funds, I'll tell you this. When you want to spread funds around, when you take the fear away of losing your home, mm-hmm, because you're not working, or you take the fear away of not being hungry, then you kind of sort of have to get on your game. You have to get a little bit off. You have to do enough substance that you can make it to work tomorrow. When everything's coming in, you know, every single month, that's when you get the 2-3 generations on public assistance, you know, the substance abuse that we're talking about. So I don't really know like how much I understand programs. Welfare was started out, you know, somebody told me once when I was a rookie, I got my check, and it was like one of the, I couldn't believe how much taxes that they took out. I was bitching, and the fucking guy who was driving, the veteran cop, he goes to me, "Hey, if I told you give me $15 a week, I'll guarantee you a job, would you do it?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "That's what your taxes are for, welfare, job security." What he was saying was half the population here in New York, if you could get public assistance, you will. They're not going to be fighting for your job. That's what you're giving them. You know what I'm saying? So there's that mentality too, that it kind of sort of destroys. You need a little fear, a little flame underneath your...
It destroys motivation.
I can see what you're saying, but I think that that motivation comes from other places as well. I mean, you want to talk about like education. You want to talk about like, once again, like you have substance abuse problems in these neighborhoods. You have single parent homes. There are other things that would lead to having that mentality where it's just free money or whatever. I think it sometimes comes out of a place of ignorance much more than some kind of human nature thing. Because I imagine if, you know, like any of us, we'd still look for something to do. We would still look for, you know, a way to be productive, a way to like, you know, have some kind of satisfaction. And I think that comes from a place where we've been educated. We have some kind of a good head on our shoulders for whatever reason.
A small percentage of the ones that are living there have the fortitude to look.
Exactly. You know? But that's the problem. And that's what, there's different reasons why it's a small percentage. And that's where I think that could be addressed.
You know, it's like, you don't need no man. You know, just have the baby. We'll get money. Yeah. So now you don't need a husband because he's going to fuck it up. Because now all of a sudden you got a family and you're not going to get the assistance that you would get if you weren't married. So there's a lot of that attitude too.
Sure. No, I'm sure. And that's the question is, where does that attitude come from? It's like this attitude is cultivating a certain type of person. And a lot of times it's criminals as well.
You say, where does that attitude come from? We stopped these people working. The working people, we stopped. Mm-hmm. And we gave them $600 a week plus $400. They got $1,000 a week to stay home. And in 3 months, they got so used to that. When their job opened up again, they didn't want to go back. No, I'm scared. So you see how easily you can turn somebody around? Within 3 months, free money infected these people. And they couldn't get fucking back to work. And it's still out there.
Yeah. But there are some people, who had that effect. And then there are others who, they got the assistance and they are going back to work or they are finding other ways to make it work. And I guess the question is, why are some people different than others in that regard, you know?
I think the working poor are much prouder and much better off than people that just want free shit.
Yeah, of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The working poor are struggling, but they have pride in themselves. Whereas the people that are getting free shit, part of their life is a hustle too. They're getting the free government shit and they're also selling drugs and doing other shit, you know?
Take a whiz, man. I'll be right back.
Mark just left us.
How did we morph into this when we initially started with talking about your tour guide business?
Well, I imagine you guys talk about this kind of stuff a lot, right? I mean, it's kind of what's going on.
I mean, well, you know, a lot of this whole thing, got political too over this whole riot.
Yeah, of course. Regardless of what people think, to me the most depressing thing is people's inability to talk about it with each other.
Yeah.
You know, from whatever side, that's to me what the most hopeless and sad part about it is, because you know, throughout history in the United States, like everyone's had differences. You talk about it, and the better idea or the combination of it rises to the top. But now people just can't talk about these things, and that to me is the most unsettling.
Politically.
A
conservative can't talk to a liberal because they're going to get a fight.
I think that's. I think to me, that is the scariest thing about what's going on.
It is. It is scary. Very scary.
Because it's fine to have a difference of opinion. I think it's healthy. No one wants a tyrant on either side.
Yeah.
That's
why there's elections, and that's why there is the democracy. You know.
Exactly, but that's exactly right. I think people have started to throw out the idea of democracy, and they're just like. I mean, look, we have our differences of opinion. I think the important thing is to focus on a way to talk. And I mean, hopefully that we can get back to that place, you know, but it seems kind of like.
We have two people coming on our show Monday. And one guy's name is Pat Russo. Mm-hmm. He's a retired sergeant. And the other guy is an Irish guy. He's from Dublin. And both of them work really hard with kids. Mm-hmm. Pat Russo is working with, he runs the PBA Kids in Boxing program.
Oh, cool.
You know? And James Mooney is a celebrity photographer and groomer, and he goes into inner city and helps kids that are in gangs and tries to help them get out of it, you know? So these are two people that are trying to do something about it. They're not people that are just screaming about, this is the problem, the cops suck, this, but they're actually trying to, and that's the whole thing. Maybe these multi-million-dollar athletes should just shut the fuck up and do something about it. Same thing with these A-list actors. Go ahead, go help. Let's help. You know, let's do something about it. Let's not, you know, just talk shit about it.
Yeah, well, and also, to be fair, like, there are some actors who go about it the wrong way, for sure, and there are some, like, let's say, athletes who are doing what they can. I mean, sometimes all you can do is make, like, look at Muhammad Ali, for example, like what Muhammad Ali did. I mean, he really took a stand, and people at the time were saying, why don't you just box, do your thing, to stop, you know, poking your head in what you shouldn't be poking your head in. And in hindsight, we can see him as a hero, you know.
But there's less and less Muhammad Ali's, and there's more and more, you know, a lot of these athletes, they can't see that the big money they're making from China is horrendous. Because look how China treats people. Look at the human rights violations in China. But yet they're here waving the flag against our government. But meanwhile, they're getting $100 million a year from Nike, and Nike's got some kid making 32 cents an hour making those sneakers that this guy's making $100 million a year on.
Right? Tom, do you know Joel Richardson?
No.
Well, his father lives in China. He produces the shows out there in Royersford.
Oh, okay.
Great guy. I got to hook you guys up. Anyway, his father lives in China. So, you know, his father comes here, and I talk to him. And he loves it there, man. He says they're thriving economically. He said it's a pain in the ass if you want it. There's certain things you can't get on the internet. So, for example, if he – like, I was on the phone with him here, and he's in China. And, you know, if there's certain words that you could say you get cut off, you just call each other back.
Wow, really?
Yeah. And there's
– like, what word?
I don't know. They monitor everything. But other than that, he told me he's fucking great. He fucking loves it. He said that he's making money hand over fist.
He's not everybody, Mark. I mean,
he's a white man living in fucking China.
Yeah. And Sting is an Englishman coming to New York. So, you know what I mean? Even a song about that. I'm an Englishman in New York.
I don't know what our global perception is right now, because if you really wanted to share the footage of our riots and all, if you were in another country, you'd think it were falling apart here, or we're ready to be overthrown. So what's the difference between our riots and China's riots and anybody else's fucking riots? We don't know what's going on over there. We don't know. We really don't know. This is a perception. It's just we're being told China's bad. China's bad. China's bad. And I don't know. I don't know. There's people over there. They're fighting between the mainland and the other land. And, you know, for example, that shooting that happened over there, that was a boyfriend that got pissed off at his girl. The one thing that led to all the fucking chaos over there again. Mm-hmm. He was explaining the case to me, and it made a lot of sense. It's like, here's a boyfriend who goes over and kills his girlfriend. She goes back into the mainland. And then he runs back over to where he lives. And they can't fucking touch him. It's like, no, you fucking kill this bitch over. You gotta pay the price. And they won't let him be tried or prosecuted because he's in this other fucking, he crossed the fucking river. It's like if I committed a crime in Brooklyn and now I go to Queens and no, you can't touch him. Everybody in Queens is like, no, leave him alone. He killed his fucking girlfriend. So you don't know what's really going on.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Neither do these basketball players. We're asking these kids to pick a side. They're fucking kids, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
You're getting them involved. You know, everybody's a pawn right now. I just want to perform. I don't give a fuck. I just want to perform. That's it. That's my life. I don't care. Yeah. We're all pawns. And the police department is used, you know, you're the one unit that's being used as a deflection for everything that else is going on. Every time they say, oh, this guy stole this and this guy stole. Look at how bad the police are. Look at what the police are doing.
Yeah.
Killing people over here. They're so evil.
You know what I think they should do? I think they should take the entire New York City Council and put them out at the next riot. Let them stand there. Let them have shit thrown at them. Let them get people spitting in their face. Let them stand there and see how their politics change, you know?
Look at the council in Minneapolis. Now they're saying, well, I didn't really know what defund the police meant. Yeah, and I thought it was an idea. We didn't think we were really going to defund them. So now they have to go back and revisit this because they're being overwrought with crime. And you see what happens, man. People with money bail out. Who knows? Maybe it's a real estate strategy. I can't figure it out. I really can't, because in New York City, you used to be able to get a brownstone in Harlem for about $100,000. It's a completely dilapidated piece of shit. Nobody would do it. And then all of a sudden, the people who did that, they're selling it for $4 million.
Yeah.
And why did that happen? It happened because the neighborhood was shit, and then it got great. And guess what? Now it's going to go to shit again. So we have a turnover in real estate. It's another fucking thing you could investigate or think about.
Yeah, that's a time for Bill to for you and Bill to buy an off the cuff brownstone.
That's right. Police off the cuff have our meetings there.
You think it's a changing of wealth, but the wealthy still stay wealthy.
Well, that's the big problem, I think. One of the big problems in our country is that power is just getting concentrated in few hands, and the middle class is shrinking. It's kind of scary.
Middle class, man.
Yeah, and all the billionaires that we're getting. I mean, we're going to be ruled by billionaires.
Yeah, that's a big problem with the what happened with our capitalism, is that we have such a small percentage of people that have the money.
Yeah.
And people are manipulating our media.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to think to yourself, well, maybe they're putting out all this shit so they hold on to their fucking money.
Well, there's a big theory that all this division between common people, whatever, is good for them. I mean, everyone's busy fighting between liberal and conservative. Meanwhile, the people at the top don't give a shit.
Right.
They're like, as long as I'm getting money, it doesn't matter who's in office, you know?
Look at the three big ones. What is it? Apple, Google, Facebook.
Amazon.
Yeah, and Amazon. These companies... They're gonna run governments.
They pretty much do already. I mean, like they basically, you look at a lot of these companies, they fund both sides of the aisle. Like, they give money to Democrats and Republicans. Yeah. Meanwhile, everyone else is fighting between saying Republicans are evil, Democrats are evil, when these people are basically like, they have their hands in all of it, you know?
Well, if you think about the future and the people that are gonna be unemployed just because your job is gonna be obsolete, cars can drive themselves.
Yeah.
Truck drivers, all these other people, what do you do with them? You know, I forget who it was, but he said, this idea that everybody has to work is obscene. It's absurd. Not everybody has to work. If somebody comes up with an idea that could feed everybody for peanuts, then we don't all have to work.
Right, but the difference is it's not feeding everyone for peanuts. It's feeding everyone for the same prices, but all that money is going to the five guys who own all those robots or whatever.
My point is this, though. When you're sitting home, who's going to send you your care package on a daily basis? So you're going to sit there with a menu.
Yeah.
And you're going to pick out what you want to eat, and they're going to send it to you. It's going to come, the drone. You're going to take your lunch, and you're going to go back to playing your virtual reality or living in your virtual world in your fucking cubicle. That's an apartment. And then we already got used to living like this right now.
Yeah.
Because of COVID. You know what I'm saying? So it's not going to be so hard for people. You know, we're social beings, but we're getting socially disattached with
everything. Yeah, for sure.
You know what I'm saying?
No, you're 100% right. We're all, I mean, that whole idea of like people being detached and like, you know, and it turns everyone kind of inward. It's kind of sad, less social.
Well, that's the movie 1984. I just watched it a couple of weeks ago, man. And it bugs out because it's like...
Yeah.
It's happening, right?
I've actually never seen the movie. I've only read the book. That's one of my favorite books of all time. It's an amazing book.
Yeah, yeah. I had it for high school, I think. I might have skimmed through it. Like the back, went halfway through the back.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to have George Orwell come on next week, and Mark's got to read that book by then.
I think Bill just wanted to show off that he knew it was George Orwell.
I knew who wrote it. Show how educated I am.
Yeah, that was one thing.
Product of the state system, you know.
There you go, baby. New York.
Community, buff state, and CUNY, John Jay, you know.
That's very impressive.
At the beginning, we were getting all these books from, because we were getting authors on the show. So we get a book, and then, like, I would try my best. I would start reading it, but you know, I'd get like, you know, 12 pages in. I'm like, this book is great, but the interview is tomorrow, you know? So I started a lot of books.
It's too late. That's right. We do get sent a lot of books, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Mark, we're like an hour and 35 minutes into this. I didn't know if we'd...
Went by quick, man.
Look at that. We covered a lot of ground, I think.
I think we solved most of the world's problems.
Yeah, that's usually what happens when three comedians get in on a Zoom.
That's right. Tom, you're a great guest, though, man. And if you want me to do like that murder tour with you.
Of course, dude. I'd love to have both of you guys do some videos. That'd be fun.
Which ones we're going to do, you know?
You know, the reason why I was picking your brain with the thing with tour was because I'm going to need some other employment. You said that test is pretty easy. I know
It's pretty easy. You should take it. I think the problem is right now, Mark, is there's not a ton of tour guide work. That's the big –
As we start building up again, whatever, it's definitely something that I would love to do.
Dude, I'm telling you, it's the best job I've ever had. Like you really – you're performing in a way. You can try your jokes and goof off, and also you meet people every single day. You're talking about –
I love that. I'm a people person.
It's the best. Yeah, you would be great at it, dude.
And I love talking, and I love New York, so it's a perfect. Yeah.
Dude, you would be great, and people would flip for a chance to like do a tour with a former NYPD.
Yeah,
detective.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you kidding me?
It's definitely something fun.
It's a slam dunk.
You know what's funny? Before we go, I just want to tell you something. The reason why this whole show and everything that started with all this police off the cuff shit was. Because I was driving around with this detective. Bill knew him. He was a Manhattan North detective, homicide detective. He was a powerlifter guy. And he was a little bit old, and he was about to retire. And we're driving through, when I say old, I mean, you know, for a police department.
Yeah, you got to get out when you're 63.
Yeah, yeah. He was in phenomenal shape. And we're driving, I'm driving him. And, you know, he's just going like this. He goes, "Oh, this is somebody got killed on this corner here," and he knew the date.
Yep.
Time. Next block. Oh, somebody got shot right there.
Yeah.
That name. And he knew. And I'm like thinking to myself, this guy is a computer.
Yeah.
His brain is a computer. He knows all these homicides. What a shame that this guy's going to retire. It's just like Jerry Seinfeld when he said, "Where do the jokes go?"
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Where do these stories go? Where does this information go?
Yes.
And that's how me and Bill started working on the podcast, because all these people have these great stories and they're retiring or they're retired. And why do they have to go and just die off somewhere? Let's memorialize them. Let's get them on video.
You're 100% right, dude. And that's what's so great about like all the mediums that are available to us. You have the YouTube, you have the podcasting, all that. That's the reason I got Bill on that video we did. I met Bill at an open mic at the Stand. Yeah. And we would just go to the same open mic, and I would just keep going there, and I was just listening to Bill, and I was like, this guy's great. He's hilarious, but he's also got these incredible stories. And I think Bill had just started stand-up at the time.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just got to get this guy on a video. So we did exactly what you just described. We drove around, and Bill just pointed to this corner. He's like, "Oh, I found a suitcase full of body parts here. The landlord paid her sons to kill some guy here," and all this. I'm just like, what is going on? This is crazy. So I just had to get him on a video. It was the best.
Yeah, and then me and Bill did it. We drove around and we all the places we used to get food on the arm.
Yeah.
I used to go over here. I get my dessert over here. Then I get my rice and beans over here. The chicken was good over here.
You know, the guy he was talking about was almost like 63 years old, but he was like a bull, you know. He came in one day and goes, "You know, Sarge," "I was lifting today. I had 365 on the bar. My shoulder gave me a little twinge. I got to stop lifting that heavy."
Jeez, 365. Get out of here.
Yeah, he can bench 405, this guy.
Good Lord.
But you know, you can't really do that when you're alone, because if you get stuck, you know.
Yeah. I was a bodybuilder for years. So when I come up, I know power lifters, you know. He's basically sitting like this in the seat like this while we're driving around. And his suit fits kind of like weird. You know what I'm saying?
He had monstrous arms.
He's off the rack suit, so he has to buy like a 54 jacket. He's really he's just it doesn't fit his head. He's like,
Oh man, that's the best.
But we have to plug the Patreon for anybody who's still tuned in, who's still with us after an hour and a half. Don't forget, we have the Patreon. We're looking for people to help us out so we keep this show moving and growing and production value and all this stuff. We got to get an engineer because poor Bill over there.
I don't know what happened tonight. It just drives me crazy when that happens, you know.
But
thousands of people watching now, we're going to get hundreds, you know.
Well, what's the Police Off the Cuff Patreon? Is Police Off the Cuff on Patreon?
Well, we have a Police Off the Cuff. Mark does one-on-one with Mark DeMeo, where he hits a guest and interviews the person. I do real crime stories, where I'll have a detective or someone that's been on the job, and they'll tell a real case. They'll tell a real story of what happened. And these are true, real crime stories. And our Patreon, OTCpod1@gmail.com, right, is our, but you can get on OTCpod1/policeoffthecuff. No, actually, it's patreon.com/policeoffthecuff. And we have three tiers. The cheapest one is called the bucket. So if you want to be the bucket, that's $7 a month. The next level is polish my rack. That costs $9. And the premier, number one level, is dipped in butter, and that costs $11 a month, and everyone wants to have them dipped in butter. So that's what you should aspire to, join the dipped in butter level.
This week I have a great guest from my one-on-one, and his name is Timmy Hall. He's a hilarious comedian. He was a cop for 23 years in Baltimore. He's been on BET's Comic View. He's been on Def Comedy Jam. And he's got a lot of really, really funny cop material. I just put our interview up on Patreon, and he's still doing the cop material right now in the middle of all this. And he said it's going great. So he inspired me to maybe start doing my cop material again. Yeah. But in the meantime, I want to thank Tom Delgado.
Yeah, thank you guys, man. It was so good to hang out with you guys and talk. And just, I haven't seen you, Mark, in a bit.
You're one of the best comedians I've met. I mean, human beings. Comedians I've met doing comedy, you know, a lot of comics are good people, but there's a lot of dickheads out there too, you know.
Yeah, you're right, man. It's like anything else. We were just talking about that.
True. It's like anything else, but you're one of the guys.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, obviously you're a lawyer, but you can hold your own. You don't have to. You realize that even though we have opinions, and that we may not be 100% right, and that's the way life is. You need. I like arguing. I like, you know, changing ideas with people, not so I can force my idea down your throat, but just so I can hear what you have to say. It might change my
And but it's important, man. It's important.
He's done research on everything, though. If you really call him on it, he'll say, I have this. He'll even quote the page he got out of it.
Good.
Well, you know, it's super important just to have these kind of conversations, man. I think that's one of the scariest things. And I was just telling this to Bill. The scariest thing is that these conversations aren't being had.
Right.
At best, you're just having people yell at each other about stuff, and no one's listening to anything.
Well, you know something? It's like a lot of these millennials, they get triggered, and they bitch out. You know what I mean? I've seen them. They trigger, and they get
asking these young people to be informed about politics when they want to live their life. So they're going to learn whatever they have to know so they feel like they're on the right side of the history, and that's it. I don't want to talk about it anymore. I wanted to fucking have fun. I'm a fucking teenager. I'm a college student. What do you keep asking me questions about politics for? I never had to deal with that at such a young age. Nobody gave a shit about politics until, I don't know. It's just, you know, for me, it's recently. But anyway, Tom, I'm going to hit you up for, I want to know more about the sightseeing. And I want.
Yeah, man. I think you'd be great. I think you'd be great. You should definitely do it.
I would love to do it, man. I think that's my new, I'm excited about it.
And it's like, good money, too.
Finally, there's something I want to do. And obviously, I'm going to have to learn more about New York. I'm going to start reading up tomorrow.
Man. Well, just let me know if you need it.
You see that fucking building over there? Hey, this guy jumped off the building 2 years ago.
Now, give me money.
I'm going to hit you up, because even if it's the most the basic travel company, whatever. And just...
Yeah, well, dude, right now would be the time to learn all this stuff, because you have time.
Yeah, I am. I'm going to look it up.
All right.
All right. Thanks for tuning in, man.
Of course, man. Of course. Thank you guys for having me. It's good to see both of you guys.
And hopefully we'll bump into each other again at a gig.
For sure, man.
Future.
Fingers crossed.
I look forward to it.
Tom,
all right.
Great having you, man.
Guys, thank you so much. I'll talk to you guys both soon.
All right. Bye-bye.